Hello, and welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation's Today's Topics in Health Disparities. I'm Marcia Lilly Blanton, Senior Advisor on Race, Ethnicity, and Healthcare at the Foundation. For those of you who have not joined us for a prior discussion, Today's Topics is an interactive, live webcast series that addresses issues relating to disparities in health and healthcare in the U.S. The goal is to raise the level of understanding of these disparities and encourage greater dialogue about the problems and promising solutions. Today's topic, Race and Genetics, the Future of Personalized Medicine, examines the growing interest in using genetic information to individualize patient care and its potential for reducing health disparities between racial and ethnic groups. Many social scientists and epidemiologists consider race a social construct that reflects shared historical experiences, social environments, and culture. In a recent article, Dr. Yancey, one of our panelists today, described race as a polarizing issue in America that has no identified genetic basis, and yet a burgeoning new field that links race, genetics, and personalized medicine is raising expectations of improvements in health through the use of tailored drug therapies. At least two relatively recent announcements suggest that sizable resources are being devoted to this new endeavor. In March 2008, the National Institutes of Health announced the establishment of the Center for Genomics and Health Disparities within the National Human Genome Research Institute. And in December of 2007, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, often referred to as PhRMA, issued a press release announcing there were almost 700 new drugs in development for diseases that disproportionately affect African Americans. While the vast majority of efforts underway around genetics and personalized medicine are not focused on specific racial or ethnic groups, today's discussion will center on an emerging field at the intersection of these three areas. Some scientists and clinicians think this new field of inquiry has the potential for big payoffs in clinical care. Others are concerned that the risk outweigh the potential benefits. Most, however, agree that medical advancements that come from better knowledge about the body's genetic makeup should be similarly available across racial and ethnic groups. Should the public, policymakers, or clinicians be concerned about generalizations that describe the benefits of medications for specific racial or ethnic groups? What is the quality of evidence showing differences between racial ethnic groups in clinical effectiveness of medications? We'll explore these and other questions today with our guest. In our studio today, we have three distinguished panelists whose bios are on our website. We're pleased to have with us Dr. Claude W. Yancey, Medical Director of the Baylor Heart and Vascular Institute and Chief of Cardiothoracic Transplantation at the Baylor University Medical Center. We also have Dr. Richard A. Levy, President of Levy Consulting and formerly Vice President for Scientific Affairs at the National Pharmaceutical Council. And we have attorney and professor Dorothy Roberts, Kirkland and Ellis Professor at the Northwestern University Law School. Thank you for joining us. Before I turn to our panelists, let me remind our audience that we welcome your questions. So email us at ask@kaisernetwork.org. Dr. Yancey, let me start with you. Can you just give us an overview of this emerging field of genetics and individualized medicine? And what does that mean to a physician? And what are the implications of that field for communities of color?
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here, but even more so for the opportunity to publicly vet this issue, mm-hmm. because it is an emerging field and it's extremely important. Mm-hmm. And the best way to obtain a context here is to understand what drives the interest. It's really not just academic curiosity, but it comes from a series of observations that are longstanding that within certain groups of individuals, certain diseases and the characteristics of those diseases appear to cluster. Once we see a clustering that appears to be different from others, we would like to understand that clustering, whether or not it has to do with the environment, whether it has to do with the socioeconomics, or whether it has to do with the science, the biology, and perhaps even the genetics. So as one starts to enter into this field, we begin first with just simple observations that in some individuals, mm-hmm. diseases are more evident. Mm-hmm. We then seek explanations. And one of the more fruitful directions to understand why we see this clustering is to begin to make demographic observations that appear to suggest that some diseases are aligned as a function of race, and then partner that with certain scientific observations, in this case genetics, but there could be other scientific mm-hmm. observations, to understand whether or not there is a sufficient linkage between the genetics, the observation of disease, and the demographics in which those diseases are housed, that we can then begin to understand more about why certain people are at risk. But here is the big payoff. If the entirety of this interest was because race was the end game, then this is really for naught, because it only polarizes, to use that word again, mm-hmm. the environment. Mm-hmm. But if it allows us to learn something about disease, to understand a unique profile or set of markers that really anticipate or predict disease, and then that profile can become a probe for all others in the community, now we've utilized the observation to understand more science to have a greater impact on health. And so that really is the broad overview: observing clustering of issues, seeking science as an explanation, developing new knowledge, and in the process, specifically addressing the unique needs of those that appear to be disproportionately affected.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we know that, which we've learned from the human genome work, that 99%, we are, as humans, 99% the same, how does race factor into this for either Dr. Levy or Dr. Yancey?
Well, we are 99% the same, but there are some small differences mm-hmm. that may be important in certain contexts. For example, drugs are usually metabolized, just like foods are, and this is governed by genes which drive the enzymes and so forth. Well, sometimes these genes and enzymes have variations, and it turns out that there are some correlations between different frequencies of these variations in one racial group as opposed to another. And so if the enzymes are less active, drugs tend to be metabolized slower and you get higher blood levels. So you may have adverse effects if that goes on. Mm-hmm. And there is some clustering there around racial groups. I really hesitate to say racial. It sticks in my throat all the time. Mm-hmm. Because as we're talking about this, anthropologists are increasingly getting away from the concept that races exist. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit difficult to talk about. These are groupings based on ancestral clusterings. Mm-hmm. And it's a socio-demographic concept. Mm-hmm. That's what I feel most comfortable with, and I think panelists also do as well.
Well, then I would ask, why use race at all? Mm-hmm. Why use race in this context? If we know that race is purely a social construct, it's an invented classification system that changes depending on what country you're in, changes in the United States depending on the historical period. We've had 25 different census categories, changes in the census categories. So we know that race isn't a genetic construct. There's no way of identifying someone's race by their genes. So why should we use race, that category, that political category, in the context of looking at genetic differences in responses to pharmaceuticals? Why use it at all in that context?
The answer is that we actually should not. But race provides a convenience. And the convenience of race is that it allows us to aggregate our observations, to see events as they occur, and then understand what elements beyond race might be involved here. Now, another perspective here gets back to your original question, Marcia, and that's that with the similarity amongst humans being so tightly mm-hmm. aligned, mm-hmm. the bigger story there is that, for the most part, the diseases will be very similar, mm-hmm. and the responses to medicines will be very similar, and the word we have to embrace is nuance. Mm-hmm. If there are differences, these differences are nuanced, and we need to understand that the big picture is still the big picture. If we're talking about heart disease, which I know about, the risk factors are the same, mm-hmm. high blood pressure, cholesterol, etc. But if we drill down to the specifics on how a certain drug may be metabolized, is someone a fast metabolizer mm-hmm. or a slow metabolizer, mm-hmm. then that may have some bearing on what we see. So race mm-hmm. is just a convenience. And it is an inconvenience when we stop at race, we have to use race as the convenience of the observation, but quickly go beyond that to understand what is there about race that makes this clustering effect or leads to these observations on metabolism.
Well, but then if you know that race is a social category, that it varies in the society over time, different societies, then isn't it more logical and scientific to say, well, the reason for this clustering must be a social reason. It must be because of health inequities, not because of health differences. And so why not look for the social reason instead of focusing on a genetic reason?
The social reasons probably do exist, and it'll be interesting to hear Dr. Levy's perspective here, but if we really understand the mechanics of race, it requires a certain lineage of intermarriage, a certain sharing of environmental factors, a certain mm-hmm. sharing of ancestral factors.
Mm-hmm.
And so there may be certain biological traits because of intermarriage and because of ancestry that do become evident. And the reason that it is intriguing scientifically mm-hmm. is because if we can probe out what particular factor appears to happen in this group of people, in these several generations, then we can extrapolate that observation to other groups. And so one can't say it's purely social. Certainly one can't say it's purely genetic because there's so much heterogeneity, so much mixing.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain signals that are concentrated in a group of individuals. Mm-hmm. And understanding those signals and going beyond race is what I think matters here.
Let me come back to a question that actually had come from someone from Richmond, Virginia, where he asked, what is the evidence that we have now that drug metabolism differs in different groups and that that different level of metabolism is genetic versus more kind of social environmental, a consequence of social environmental factors?
Well, there are a number of studies where that has been looked at, and the social and environmental has been controlled, and yet the metabolism persists in being somewhat different. And that can be traced to these genetic variations, which are quite specific. There are maybe, you know, three or four different ways a gene can present itself, and through genetic assay techniques, you can identify which of those is present in a given person. And that is correlated, in some cases, with a difference in metabolic capacity mm-hmm. for that medication. And there have been some differences shown across Asians and African Americans and Caucasians and so forth for a variety of these enzymes, which control the metabolism of a great many drugs that are available to doctors to treat patients. So it's not trivial. There's something really there, and there is science behind that, even though we can do this whole discussion without believing in race. The people just cluster. So there are differences between these clusters of people, mm-hmm. called a race or not.
Mm-hmm. And importantly, there are no absolutes.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't take a group of people that happen to be aligned with a certain demographic and assume that everyone in that group will have the same either limited response or exaggerated response. And so one starts with these crude groupings of individuals mm-hmm. and observes that, in fact, there are some differences in the cardiovascular, the heart drugs, for Asian persons, for persons of African descent, for persons of European descent. But it is not a consistent difference that is observed in everyone that happens to be in that group.
Well, one of the questions that came in asked, how do physicians in practice then apply the information that they get about differences in how drugs may or may not affect. So when a person walks in the door, walks into a physician's office, do they first look at race, or do they look at race in combination with other factors to define or identify the drug that would be best suited for that condition?
Well, we hope they don't look at race at all. Mm-hmm. Because, again, the importance of the question you raised earlier, Marcia, is that we're all so very much more alike than we are different. And the diseases are the diseases. There are certain very finite circumstances where, at the point of making a decision regarding how one is treated, that decision is in part empowered, if you will, or facilitated by realizing that some drugs or combinations of drugs might be better for this broad group of people versus another. But there's an even more important issue here. Don't allow the race presentation to hinder the decision making. Mm-hmm. Because where this becomes very problematic has less to do with selecting a given drug for a certain disease, but it has more to do with a very fundamental concern of disparate health care. Mm-hmm. Will you refer this patient on for a definitive surgical procedure as frequently as this person? Will you screen this woman as avidly for a certain condition as you will this woman, particularly when the only difference is the way they appear racially? That's the real point of friction. Mm-hmm. So for the physician practicing, my hope, my fervent hope, is that race doesn't factor into any of the decision making until we reach that very narrow field where a decision has to be made about the prescription of a medicine and there's information to guide that choice.
Mm-hmm. Let's shift the conversation a little bit to talk about efforts underway, because before we came in here, we talked a little bit about what was happening in pharma and what was happening in NIH. And I wanted to start once again with you, Dr. Yancey, just because I'd like to talk a little bit about what we know has gone on with one drug, the only drug to my knowledge, which was defined as for a specific racial or ethnic group, and that was Bidel. What evidence do we have in terms of that drug as being more effective in one group than another group, and is that something we should do more of?
Well, Marcia, thank you again for bringing this issue up, because it intersects perfectly with what we're discussing today. Mm-hmm. So there is a condition that is fairly prevalent in this country called congestive heart failure. And it occurs when the heart becomes much weaker than it should be and a person is affected with shortness of breath, fatigue, and premature death, unfortunately. That disease in some manifestations appears to be overrepresented, that is, occurs more frequently and sometimes with more compelling consequences in African Americans. Observations, which is how all of this starts, demonstrated that the responsiveness of African Americans to certain drugs for heart failure may not have been as robust as others. And again, other observations said African Americans clearly have a major problem with this disease. It happens at an earlier age. And so through a process of iterative discovery, there was identification that a combination of two older medicines, both of which are designed to relax the blood vessels, was uniquely beneficial in African Americans. The proprietary name for this was Bidel, but it's two vasodilating, relaxing medicines, relaxing for the blood vessels, that helps facilitate this condition. It is the only drug to date that the FDA has approved that has an indication by virtue of race. The uptake for that drug, unfortunately, has been disappointing. It's still available, but the manufacturer of the drug is defunct now, no longer in active marketing and sales. We continue to promote the use of the drug, the scientific paradigm, because it has a rich science and it may be revealing to us new ways to understand about heart disease. But it is a case in point of there being a therapy effective for African Americans, a therapy for a variety of different reasons, did not experience broad uptake. And now we are understanding what it was about the therapy that mattered most, that is, understanding new science, and what it was about the therapy that gave such pause to its uptake, so that we can be more learned the next time we go through
and
with any discoveries.
And was the pause to its uptake the fact that it was being defined as a race-specific, or the marketing of the drug as race-specific?
That certainly had to be a part of the dynamic. I mean, if one does the postmortem, you would think that race mattered. You would think that adding yet another medication to an already complicated disease construct, that is treatment of heart failure, that may have mattered. And there is always a hesitancy within my profession to embrace new therapies. And it's a very slow uptake, waiting to see how things occur in the real world before there's a really vigorous embrace. And the intersection of all of these things coming together resulted in it not being avidly prescribed, but it's still available, and there is some slow momentum, and hopefully it will work. What drives my continued interest in this, though, is the degree to which it works. it truly saves lives and a significant number of lives and reduces hospitalizations. And African Americans indeed are disproportionately affected by this disease. And so trying to bring together the need for effective therapies for heart failure in African Americans with the availability of this drug is a mission that I still embrace. But the need is not limited to African Americans. Heart failure is ubiquitous. If we can learn something in the treatment of African Americans that helps others, then it's a good thing.
Let me ask Dr. Levy to respond a little bit, because I actually want to talk a little bit about Crestar, which was a different drug, but AstraZeneca underwent a clinical trial for largely Hispanic populations, testing, from my understanding, Crestar against with another drug, Lipitor, and basically came forth with a conclusion that Crestar was more effective in Hispanics. So it's a different situation, a different population, a different condition, but still similar in the sense that you had a clinical trial that included only one, at least in this case, ethnic group. So can you tell us more about how that differed and what...
A little bit. I don't think it's necessarily that Crestar is more effective in Hispanics, but Crestar tends to be one of the stronger lipid-lowering drugs, so it's generally more effective than others. Now it's it's not indicated for all patients. Every patient does not need the strongest drug. Mm-hmm. The physician picks the right statin drug for the patient at hand, but it happens to be among the stronger ones and appears now to be appropriate for different ethnic and racial groups based on these tests. And it wasn't just Hispanics. They did additional tests with African Americans and Hispanics, Caucasians, and South Indian people of Indian heritage. And they found that the drug works for all of these different ethnic groups, which is oddly enough a little unusual in terms of research, because usually clinical trials are not powered enough to detect reliably drug effects in subgroups, ethnic and racial subgroups. It is difficult to recruit these individuals into clinical trials for a variety of reasons we may want to talk about later. It is expensive to do that. These represent maybe 20% of the market, so there's a business decision whether to include them or not and to what extent. So it's rather complicated. But when all the dust settles, it is usually the case that minority groups are not substantially included in the clinical trials. AstraZeneca, in this case, went out of its way to do this in three separate studies, forming a constellation of studies. And so they showed that the medication, in fact, works in these different groups, which is, frankly, no big surprise. You would expect it to. It's nice to see that it happened. They did find, however, interestingly, my understanding is in the South Indian group, that the blood levels of the drug for the same dose was much higher. There may be a metabolic issue there that we talked about previously. So these are the kind of things at the margins that are very good to know, and this is why the different ethnic and racial groups should be included if possible, if commercially possible, if logistically possible, in these clinical trials.
So were there
trials.
Differences in the claims that were made about Crestar versus the claims that were made about Bidel that might help us in knowing how we move forward in?
I don't know about the claims. Bidel was directed, the study was directed only at African Americans. Mm-hmm. They didn't look at other groups. That was done in previous studies, and the results were kind of wishy-washy, and that's why they had to do this focused clinical trial in African Americans. So the Bidel showed that this drug works in African Americans. Their test had nothing to say about whether it works in anybody else, which is fine. It's a very important therapy for African Americans. So those are some of the differences.
So the question is, at what point do we begin to make claims that are race or ethnic specific?
Well, I think you can't make any race or ethnic specific claim about Bidel because there was no comparison study. It showed that it worked dramatically well in the African Americans who were in the clinical trial, but that doesn't mean it works better for African Americans than any other group because other groups weren't compared to African Americans. It also doesn't say why it worked so well for African Americans. there's no evidence from the clinical trial that it worked well for genetic reasons. It might have worked well for them because of other conditions that those participants in the study had, like high rates of diabetes or obesity, or other factors that just weren't looked into in that particular study. I know there are other follow-up studies being done, but I would say from the clinical trial of Bidel, it showed that it works well for some people. And I agree with Dr. Yancey, it shouldn't be, there shouldn't be barriers to it being marketed for people who benefit from it, but I don't think there's evidence that African Americans benefit uniquely from it. Mm-hmm. There's just no basis to say that.
Let's bring you back in the conversation, because my understanding is that there was a prior trial with Bidel that did not show it to be effective in whites.
So there were two previous studies, both of which were well-designed and were reported and peer-reviewed in the medical literature, that demonstrated that there was a soft benefit for the earlier iteration of Bidel.
A soft benefit for whom?
For the overall groups.
Everybody.
For everybody.
Exactly. It wasn't.
But the benefit was driven by the especially strong response seen in the African American group. This is called a retrospective analysis, and it's always problematic, or it's a struggle for us scientifically when we look backwards at something that's already been done, because it's a highly qualified assessment. So the right thing to do when you see such a signal that may have had such a profound effect on the result is to look at that particular group prospectively going forward, which is why the next study, the third study, was an African-American-only study, because that was a study in whom the signal had been seen. It is correct that it doesn't mean that there aren't others within the community who would respond uniquely to the combination of these two drugs that relax blood vessels. But certainly the preceding studies did not identify any other group with as robust a response as the African American seemingly had. And the one thing about this that is very, very important, the Bidel story has to be put in the context of the disease being treated. Heart failure kills people. This is not a nuisance disease. This is not something that just makes you feel not quite so well. It kills people, and here is a therapy that saves lives.
But let me just go back and ask then, if there was some evidence that it had benefit broadly, why not have the next clinical trial include both whites and African Americans?
So had there been, with the earlier studies, evidence that there was a significant benefit across the board, there would have been no need for another trial, because the drug would have gone forward with FDA approval. It was taken to the FDA based on those two previous studies and did not receive the approval to go forward. So again, in the most rigorous peer review construct we have, an intriguing idea but not strong enough to go forward. But by the by, you have this one group that seemed to have an unbelievable response. Can you come back to us and tell us if that's valid or not? And in so doing, you see that it was valid, and we do have a circumstance where a group has a response. One of the other things that's interesting, and again, what I know is the cardiovascular space, there are a few cardiovascular drugs where we clearly have sorted out the whys and the how comes and the wheres and what it is that makes the drugs work. We base so much of what we do as practitioners on our observations from clinical trials that sometimes don't have the depth of science that we would wish. And so when we apply this elevated metric to the story of these vasodilating drugs for African Americans, we are pushing it to a level that was not required for other treatment strategies. It's just an interesting thought process.
You know, time is limited, so I do feel like we need to move on. But I do think that, that there's a lot that we can learn in the testing process and in the marketing process that may help us as we move forward to the next arena. And I want to talk a little bit about what NIH is doing now, because NIH has now just recently announced the formation of a new center on genomics and health disparities. And you know, in describing that center, they say this takes us into the 21st century in terms of medicine. So my question to you is that, in your mind, where we're moving? I mean, is personalized medicine now moving deeper and deeper into the area of genomics in clinical care?
My hope is that it indeed is going that direction, mm-hmm. but that it will quickly bypass race and that we will simply be dealing with databases that have to do with either genes and the risk for disease mm-hmm. or genes and the response to medicines. Mm-hmm. We may historically go back and say this is why we saw certain disease situations in certain groups of people, but we need to quickly go beyond that. And as we're embracing genetics, we can't forget all the other things involved here. Socioeconomics is incredibly important. When Dr. Levy was talking about the use of a drug to lower cholesterol in African Americans and in Hispanics, the really compelling issue is, can we get any drug to lower cholesterol available to all at risk? Mm-hmm. Because when you start talking about a specific proprietary drug with an extra cost, that doesn't benefit people that don't have access to care. And so that's a part of this as well.
The access issue is really, it's you can have wonderful drugs, but if they're not on the formulary or they're on a tier, that's the fourth tier, and there's a $60 copay, few people get the benefit of the medication. And that, by the way, is, I think, part of the reason that Bidel went down in flames. The insurers were putting it on a very high tier, and it just became not feasible. It was a commercial failure for that reason. It's a very, very poor cautionary tale about others who may wish to develop medications like that. You know, so who's the next company who's going to jump into that space? I haven't seen one yet. They've seen the terrible example.
Back to your point, the NIH really does need to embrace this so we can understand the science much better than we do now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they also have to embrace, I think, the critical role of social inequity that affects health. Again, I think we have to say that the main reason why there are these drastic health disparities along racial lines has to be because of social inequity. It can't be because of genetics, because genetics don't define races. Races aren't defined according to genetics. It has to have to do with social inequity. And the key is, how are we going to do more about addressing the social inequities, inequities in health, inequities in income, in jobs, in discrimination, access to health care, access to housing, toxic environments across the board that impact health as well.
Let's take this point a little further, because the reality is that resources are not infinite. And so if we're going to have to make trade-offs, how do we partition our resources so that we are looking both at the biological and the social and addressing disparities?
I think one concern is that if the public believes that the reason for health inequities is biological, genetic. I mean, there are biological effects of racism, so it is biological, but it doesn't have to do with inherent genetic differences. And I think if the public believes that the reasons have to do with inherent genetic differences among so-called races, that there may be less of a willingness to pay for research that looks at the social reasons and also for changing the social reasons. I'm very concerned with the move away from social efforts, public efforts to address social disparities, the move away from government funding of social programs, for example, and whether that is connected to this resurgence in interest in genetic explanations for racial difference. Is there a connection between the two? I think there probably is, and that's something I think we have to be very, very attentive to.
I would agree. I think the genetic aspect is not the primary thing here. It's a socioeconomic thing. You know, for example, you can have wonderful drugs that are genetically tuned to the individual, everything is just right. But if people have poor health literacy and do not understand the label on the prescription vial, they won't take the medication properly. Or if people don't understand the concept of chronic disease, where the medication has to be taken whether or not you have symptoms, if people are not educated to that, the most wonderful drug, the most targeted, personalized drug in the world will fail in that person. So there's a larger issue here of bringing everybody on board to really improve the throughput of these medicines so they work for everybody. And that is a big challenge.
People also might not need the medicines as much if we had a more equitable society where people were not bombarded by discrimination. I think some of the most interesting research having to do with race is looking at the biological impact of experiencing racism every day of your life. That has a tremendous effect on people's health as well. So there's that level, as well as the level of access to medications. What is driving the perceived increased need of blacks and other people of color for these medications? Is it the social inequities that we experience?
So certainly we should be sensitive to everything we've just heard, because one cannot dismiss the heft and burden of race and racism. And one has to be cognizant of all of the social dynamics that are involved in terms of access to care. And I like the phrase health literacy, because that needs to be elevated amongst all, and prescribing patterns need to be equitable as well. But we also have to appreciate that this is a complicated field, and the word we use in medicine is multifactorial. And it really is an appropriate word, because some of it is sociologic, some of it is environmental, some of it is biologic. We can't focus on one at the expense of the others. And as incorrect as it would be to assume that the entirety of the difference we see is genetically based, it would be similarly incorrect to assume that the entirety of the difference that we see is socially based. You can measure socioeconomic status. You can quantitate it. And there are any number of examples where once one measures socioeconomic status and makes certain appropriate statistical adjustments, there still are markers of disease that predominate in one group versus the other. And so it really is a multifactorial environment that requires our attention in all domains. And if there is something, and this is what I continue to embrace, if there is something within the discovery of the clustering of events in one group of persons that allows us to better understand why that same disease occurs across the board, then it's for the good to better understand that issue. Again, if the end game is just race, then it only creates more polarization, more sensitivity, more volatility. But if it's all about science and understanding the disease process, then I think it's for the good.
Let me ask a question that came in from one of our viewers. The question is, how much of the effort to develop race-based medical treatments is actually fueled by science, that is, evidence of genetic or biological differences among races, or the desire to make money by identifying new markets for pharmaceuticals? It's a very charged question. That's why I read it. But I would like to get your thoughts on it.
I think in Dr. Yancey, your description of how Vital was developed, I think you focused on probably your particular perspective of the interest in discovering why is there this increased mortality among African Americans, although it's controversial how much of an increased mortality there is, I think. But let's leave that alone. Why is there? But you did leave out the part of the story that has to do with the Jay Cohen not being able to get FDA approval based on the first set of studies, and then seeking a renewal of a patent based on this race-specific use of this combination of generic drugs. His first patent did not pertain to race, and his first effort to get FDA approval did not involve race at all. So it was only after he sought an extension of the patent, now with this race-specific application, that the focus on race came to the forefront, and the clinical trial, the AHEF trial that just involved African Americans, took place. So clip. I was not involved at all in the discussions about why Bidal should be marketed as a race-specific drug, but it clearly had to do with patent protection and marketing, as well as this interest in discovering why there were higher rates of mortality from heart failure among African Americans. There's that piece of the story as well. I think that is important. How important, how pivotal, I think people debate that, but it still is a piece of the story, I think, that needs to be told as well.
Mm-hmm. When I started, or in my introduction, I talked about the fact that pharma issued a press release last year. There were some 700 new medications in development for African Americans, or for diseases that disproportionately affected African Americans. And I don't know if, Dr. Levy, if you're familiar with any of those new developments or new drugs, but if you are, could you tell us more about what the motivation is, to the extent you know? And let me say to our audience that we did ask for pharma if there was a representative that could be available for this show, and there was no one that they had who was available. So I know you don't speak for pharma or any mm-hmm. of the pharmaceutical companies, but you have worked very closely with the industry, and so I'm just looking for your insights.
It's probably safe to say that the prescriptions for most of those drugs, when they come to fruition, which most of them won't because they're in development and mm-hmm. they usually fail, but those that do, the most of the market will not be persons of color, mm-hmm. but will be the majority population. Mm-hmm. But they will also be helpful to people of color who disproportionately have those diseases. It's like a rising tide also lifts mm-hmm. that ship. Mm-hmm. The motivation for doing all these drugs is not to serve that minority marketplace in particular, because it's not a big enough marketplace to justify all of that research and development. It costs about $1 billion a year to develop a drug now, and companies need to understand what the potential market for it is. So they try for as broad a scope as possible in targeting a medication. But it is true that for diseases, all right, there are 29 drugs in development for cancers, many of which are overly represented in persons of color, 114 drugs in development for cardiovascular disease, mm-hmm. Diabetes, there are 95 in, respiratory 77 in, and three drugs in development for sickle cell anemia, okay? Because that reflects the size of that potential market. So the pharmaceutical industry is a commercial beast, so to speak, and they will do things that support the commercial viability of the company. That's the basic structure here. So, but I think they wanted to point out that the efforts of this industry will help minority populations, mm-hmm. perhaps disproportionately help minority populations to the extent that the diseases are disproportionately prevalent in those populations. But it is not true that they're developing 600 drugs for minorities. Mm-hmm. I don't think they meant that, but that ain't what's happened. That mm-hmm. ain't what's happening.
I'd like to go back to the question that the viewer sent in and address the response, because it is important that we have a really careful discussion on this issue of, was there an ulterior motive or a profit motive? And I certainly can't speak for those that started mm-hmm. the initiative. When I became involved, it was really trying to understand the clinical circumstances mm-hmm. and the science. But it does raise the one important question. There is a fear that exploitation is a possibility. Mm-hmm. And that may have even been part of the hindrance to the uptake of the drug. Interestingly, within patients, not within practitioners, why was this done just focusing on me? Who's gaining from this? And it identifies a very unique sensitivity in our community at large that has to be addressed in the context of these several hundred or fewer drugs that are going forward, that we have to be very careful that the hypothesis, the reason, is mm-hmm. set forward very clearly, the methods are very transparent, and that the ultimate benefit is fully explained and accounted for. Mm-hmm. We can't and shouldn't dismiss the opportunity for there to be a positive return. That's the society, that's the environment in which we live. so be it. But this should be driven by the science, and there should be transparency. So if there are lessons learned going forward, we need to be very clear that we assuage those concerns about exploitation at the very outset. My own sense is that that was a lesser issue in the story of Baidu and its rise and fall, but I accept the fact that others take a different viewpoint.
So let's talk about some of the ethical issues of using race, ethical and legal issues, you know, of using race in the development of medications and treatments. I mean, we know that the issues of race are very polarizing. So is this an approach that we should encourage? Is this an approach that we should be skeptical about?
My opinion is we should encourage the use of race to explore the impact of racism on health. Mm-hmm. I don't see a justification for using race as a genetic category because it's not defined genetically. I think there that it's so easy for it to be used in unscientific ways because people identify their race according to so many different criteria. I could imagine a family where everyone is genetically related and each child identifies being in a different race. And so if they're participating in clinical trials or presenting in doctor's offices, the idea that their racial identification has something to do with their genetics, I just think to me that is an unscientific way of thinking about the role of genetics and health, mm-hmm. that the race is not a good category for that. I think it's an excellent category and an imperative category for understanding how racism, how the inequities based on race in a society affect people's health. Mm-hmm. And that's the rule I would use going forward. But that's my opinion.
Do you?
I was just trying to think 10 years into the future, uh-huh. when hopefully all this race stuff disappears in terms of medicine, when we hopefully can be well on our way to being able to genotype individual people, regardless of what they look like, regardless of who they self-identify with in terms of racial aspects. It cuts right under that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if 10 years is the right number. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Dr. Yancey may have some view on that. I think he and I, you know, probably agree that we wish this would go away. And you know, what do we do until the doctor comes, so to speak? What do we do until the data comes where we have enough individual information? And the time course of that is susceptible to hype. And I just don't know what that's about. I'd like to get your view on that.
Well, unfortunately, it won't go away.
No.
Because we are amalgam of different peoples. And so there are things beyond the construct of medicine that will continue to define groups
of
people.
I mean, racism would go away, but I mean, the, you know, they focus on it in
but
the context.
But I will say this. I think in response to your question and in response to Dr. Levy, my sense, surprisingly, is that we should not, again, do a race-based clinical trial. Mm-hmm. I think the right thing to do is acknowledge the demographics of our country. We've just recently been made aware that sooner than 2050, there will no longer be a majority population, it will just be pluralities. And so we'll have groups of people, large groups of people. And as a practicing physician, we have to care for all persons who present. And it is simply a reality of the clinical practice of medicine that we will continue to see the clustering of risk factors, the clustering of diseases, and some nuances in the response to therapies. Mm-hmm. So the better approach would be to do the simpler, larger clinical trials that make a very good faith effort to incorporate women, mm-hmm. persons of older age, persons ascribing to different racial categories, so that at the end of that process, we know that the result that we observe is a result with which we can have a certain comfort that when applied broadly, the benefit will be seen broadly. There may be other reasons to pursue race separately, as you've commented upon, but in the context of medicine, we have to understand truly how heterogeneous our population is becoming and how quickly it's becoming that way. And the very necessity of race, that is, intermarriage within a group, that's going away. Mm-hmm. And so you'll end up with a circumstance where it will be a historical footnote.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions we got in, is there a need for greater institutional oversight of race-based scientific claims? Because while you're saying that you don't encourage greater race-based clinical trials, we are seeing race-based clinical trials underway and race-based claims being made, such as what we saw FDA's approval of Bidel. So how do we then monitor and regulate and review or heavily, more better scrutinize those claims?
So there are published guidelines that govern how we as investigators and physician scientists should incorporate race in our clinical trial design and in the reporting of clinical trials. And in a qualitative, broad sense, those guidelines basically say, establish the necessity to evaluate this disease process a function of race, i.e., not just a business imperative, but is there, in fact, a factual observation that requires focused attention? Allow individuals to self-describe their race. Mm-hmm. Don't describe it for them, which is terribly problematic for the Hispanic group if you assume race, because that's mm-hmm. very awkward, very difficult. And then to be clear in your representation of the information, which group had what observation and what experience. And so those guidelines are published. They do exist. Greater adherence to those guidelines would be an important step moving forward. I'm not sure what the institutional part is in the question, mm-hmm. but what works well in the construct of medicine is for refereed guideline statements to be created, to which most people generally will comply.
Mm-hmm. One of the flies in that ointment, though, is recruiting of, if there's basis to include different subgroups in the study based on some scientific information. The challenge then is to recruit people into this clinical trial, who it's been typically difficult to recruit persons of color into clinical trial mm-hmm. for a variety of reasons, and for many of which are come by honestly, and mm-hmm. the challenge is to improve that by education, by a variety of means, so that they can be properly represented when it's appropriate to include such groups.
Well, that's really why I wanted to make the point about exploitation, because one of the lessons learned from doing the African American heart failure trial experience is for what ordinarily would have been a recruitment scheme where for every 8 to 10 persons approached, one patient would agree to participate, we were somewhere in the 20 to 30 to 40 before we had one person agree to participate. So it demonstrates that either there was an inherent inability to communicate our intent, or there was an embedded fear questioning the integrity of our intent. In either regard, it clearly was an inertia point that was huge. Mm-hmm. And if the vision I have of going forward with large-scale trials that broadly incorporate lots of people is to be realized, then we have to exactly address what you've said, find a way to get through those inertia points of recruitment.
There's actually some research on that indicates that if persons are really informed of what's in it for them in the trial, that this is supported by their physician, this is what they might be able to see as a benefit from this trial for themselves and in general, and just fill them in entirely on what the situation is, that it kind of inspires trust and goes a long way to offset the reticence and reluctance that you're reporting on now. So it is not a dire situation, but with some energy and intelligence, this I think this is more easily addressable than some of the other issues we've talked about today, in terms of social inequities and so forth. This is pretty focused.
Right. Before we close, let's take some time to talk about health disparities and whether or not this new era of genomics is going to help move us closer to reducing disparities or potentially could widen disparities by racial and ethnic groups. Because certainly that's what the NIH Center is saying that it wants to do, to help reduce disparities.
I can see one way it might. You know, to the extent we have better genomic information on persons, then it becomes somewhat easier to identify the right medication for the right person, or at least circumscribe that a little bit better. Mm-hmm. That would mean that such medications, if you follow the logic, should be available on formularies and on preferred lists and so forth. And as it is now, we have seen some disparities in what's available to minority groups through their insurance programs as opposed to other insurance programs. So it might help leverage up the inclusion of more appropriate drugs to be available to people who are now being discriminated against in subtle backdoor ways. I mean, that's quite a few dots to connect, but there may be some truth to that.
I actually would say we should be concerned aligning genetic discoveries with an opportunity to explain disparities. I say that because I embrace the definition of disparate health care that was reported by the Institute of Medicine in 2002 with the support of the Kaiser Family Foundation and the American College of Cardiology Foundation, which suggested that disparate health care reflects those differences in health outcomes that remain after you account for the biology, for the patient preference, and in fact are couched within this bucket of stereotyping, bias, or other cultural inequities, maybe based on language or economics, that drive certain circumstances. So by the strict definition of disparate health care, I would think that that requires a different effort. Obviously, from the tone of my comments, I completely support the genetic inquiries because I think it allows us to quickly go beyond race and look at precise markers of disease. But I would be concerned with too tight a linkage between the genetic discoveries and explanations for disparate health care. Explanations for differences is very likely to occur because some of those differences will be driven by genetics, some of those differences. But the disparate component, I think, reflects a more behavioral issue in healthcare delivery.
And as I said before, my concern, and the concern of many other people too, is that by linking race and genetics, linking this political, social category to genetics, there will be less of an effort to look at the social inequities that lead to health inequities. And so we have to be very careful, I think, in how this genetic research is done. And again, my recommendation would be to disconnect it from race, because race is not a genetic category. It's a political category.
But it still provides a clustering of events. And it's the natural experiment. When we see more events occur in this group, we want to understand those events, whether those events are based on risk factors or biological markers or genetic markers. We have to have the courage to raise the questions, get those answers, and then go forward with new information that goes beyond race.
And I think we do need ways of making sure that when that's done, it's very clear that race isn't being used as a genetic category, because it isn't
and
a genetic category.
Let's close on that point, because I think it helps us to show really the controversy and the complicated issues that we are facing. I mean, this is a problem that is multifactorial, and the question is, what role does genetics play? We are in a whole new frontier of research and work, and I think our discussion today is to begin to raise the issue in such a way that we can all pay closer attention and make sure that we are at the table discussing, reviewing, and having input as these issues are coming forward. So let me thank all of you. I'd like to thank each of our panelists, Dr. Yancey, Dr. Richard Levy, and Professor Roberts. As always, your insights have helped to deepen our understanding of the challenges we're facing in this nation. I'd like to also thank all of you for your questions. I got to as many of them as I could, and I appreciate your sending them in. On our webpage, you'll find resources on today's topic that may be useful to you. Again, I'm Marcia Lilly Blanton of the Kaiser Family Foundation.